of this hour is the beginning of an interview I had done with Reverend Kevin Annette. Kevin Annette was a former minister of the St. Andrew's United Church in Port Alberni, B.C., and he has been helping to bring to light the abuses, torture, and murder that happened at the Port Alberni Indian Residential School and helped organize a human rights tribunal last June on residential schools. In this interview, Kevin shares the information that has surfaced about the involvement of the United Church, the BC government, and Native leaders in covering up torture, murder, and pedophilia against Native children that continues today. Here is that interview with Reverend Kevin Annette. I'm speaking with Reverend Kevin Annette, a former minister of the United Church in British Columbia, and I'd like to welcome you to the International Connection, Kevin.
Hi, Wayne.
I'd like to start just by going into a bit of your background and how you started with the United Church at Port Alberni, B.C.
Well, actually, right before Port Alberni, I had worked in Toronto in a downtown street mission, Fred Victor Mission, right at Queen and Jarvis there. And I worked a lot with the homeless and doing kind of social justice ministry. So I'd had, you know, a fair amount of background with urban natives in Winnipeg, Vancouver, and other places. And an opening came up in Port Alberni at St. Andrew's United Church, and I was especially interested in it because the whole history of the West Coast missionaries really started for at least the United Church and its Presbyterian predecessors right out of Port Alberni. And so it was a really interesting community. There was not only the usual social problems, but the whole relationship between the Native and the white cultures there, which was always right kind of on the edge of conflict. So I started there in the summer of 1992, and it was interesting because I remember the first visit I ever made to a Native home. It was an elderly couple out on the river west of town, and we were talking. Actually, I performed a marriage for them because after 40 years living together, they wanted to get married. Mm. But we were sitting around having coffee after, and the first thing this fellow said was, "You'll hear a lot of stories about kids being killed in that residential school. And I can tell you what happened because I know people who died." So, you know, the first week I was there, I began hearing these stories.
Hmm. And how did the other people that had witnessed this or had been involved as students in the residential school started coming forward and giving their accounts to you? How did that happen?
Well, it was partly through visiting. The St. Andrew's Church was, when I got there, it was about 25 people on a Sunday morning, all of them retired, all of them white, retired mill workers and loggers. And I was given the mandate to go out and try to, as they put it, bring new blood into the church. So part of that new blood, I assumed, since we're not officially an apartheid church, included the local Native people. And so in my visits, and also we opened a food bank in the church the second month I was there, and that began to get a lot of local Native people coming in, because probably 90% of the population, the Aboriginal population there, is on welfare. And actually Port Alberni was ranked as the second worst place in BC to live in 1993 by the provincial government. They did a study of local municipalities, and it's a typical one industry town with none of the traditional social services to support people. So when people started coming for food at our food bank, we began to hear all the other stories, and I encouraged them to come to church. So after about a year, we were up to 100 people. I had probably quadrupled the size of the church, but a lot of the people coming in were Native, they were poor, they were younger. And I had a policy on Sunday mornings where people could get up and comment from the pulpit about either things I had said or things that were on their mind and their heart. And we began to hear very, very quickly about these stories about not only the residential schools, but how the injustice of being Native in that community carried on, the racism, kind of the entrenched poverty. All of that stuff was talked about. Now, part of that, of course, was when the... I remember one incident really clearly. It was about 6 months after I got there. And the teenage suicide rate among Native families out there is probably 5 to 6 times the national average. So there wasn't one family I knew of that didn't suffer some kind of regular tragedy like that. I remember this one woman, Elizabeth, had just lost her son, who was only 16. He had killed himself. And they wanted to have me come out and baptize the entire family, and I said, why? asked her, and she said that, well, because of all the terrible things that happened in the Alberni Residential School, we figure his soul is not at rest, and he's going to come back and claim somebody else. And that kind of, for her, opened up that whole story of what had happened to her at the Alberni School. And stories that I had never even heard of, you know, even in all the official accounts. And I learned very quickly that there was a real difference between the way residential schools were being portrayed by the media, by the churches, you know, by the government, by the RCMP, and in fact what the eyewitnesses were telling us. You know, in the press you continually see this phrase, physical and sexual abuse, and, you know, the more I got into it, the more I realized this was a term created by the government around 1990 when Phil Fontaine came out, the highest paid government Indian in Canada, came out and kind of legitimized the issue when he talked about, you know, his own abuse at a residential school. And this term, physical and sexual abuse, only touches on, you know, it's the tip of the iceberg. There was a lot more going on in those schools than kids being raped or beaten up. I mean, within a year of me getting there, I was getting firsthand accounts of children being killed, tortured with electric shocks, programs of sexual sterilization happening out of United Church hospitals on the coast, and, you know, the whole gamut of other tortures, and even stories of children who were being deliberately infected with tuberculosis in some of these schools from people who had lived through that, who had been forced to sleep in the same bed with other kids who had TB. Those kind of stories I just kept hearing all the time, continually.
And what did you do anything with this information in terms of the church institution itself?
Oh, I sure did. I you know, soon after hearing that, I went to the immediate higher body in the church, which was the presbytery, what they call the Comox Nanaimo Presbytery. That's kind of the equivalent of a bishop in the United Church. They hire and fire ministers, and they kind of oversee you. That, in fact, was the body that eventually fired me without cause in 1995. I went to them with this information, and I was basically told to be quiet about it. You see, it wasn't only I who had that information. It was talked about openly in church. And the response was, among the white people there, was, we don't want to hear this. These Indian people are making it up just to get back at us for having lost their land and everything. And even the attitude within the church, well, especially within the church, was, I think the term that was used was, we can't denigrate the reputations of these missionaries. You know, these were honorable men, and we can't allow these things to be said about them. Not any concern at all whether or not this stuff might be true. And that was really surprising, because the United Church, you know, I was raised in the United Church, and I always believed that it was a church that took on and championed all sorts of causes. I mean, it has the reputation of being the most liberal denomination in Canada. It was the first to ordain women and homosexuals. And it's even made a lot of noise recently about issuing apologies and that to residential school victims. But on the ground, you see that the reality is very different. When you try to raise these things within the United Church, the boom comes down pretty quickly on you. And it wasn't just me. It happened to a whole number of other ministers and other people in the area when they tried to get at the bottom of what was going on at the residential schools.
So there were other ministers within the United Church that had discovered this information and were trying to go somewhere with it to get to see some kind of justice being done?
Apparently, there was... you see, the trouble is, there's a very mind control kind of attitude within the church, and that is, if you raise anything that's controversial or out of line, you're seen to be the one with the problem. And there's all sorts of subtle pressure at first brought upon you not to speak. And when I didn't go along with that pressure, then the pressure intensified. And the things I was encountering in Port Alberni was that a lot of people knew about these things, but there was just kind of a climate of fear and silence. So when I went to the presbytery with that information, I was told outright that I wasn't to do anything with that information. I was not to talk about it.
And what was your response to that?
Well, I mean, at that point, I realized that there was no point getting into a confrontation with the church. So what I felt was the most important thing to do was to simply allow people to continue to speak. And so I continued the practice on Sunday of doing that. We began to... You see, there were other activities that... we're involved with out of the food bank. We set up an anti-poverty group, like it was called Low Income Folks Together, or LIFT. Mm-hmm. And we began to question not simply what had happened in the past, but how, you know, those injustices were continuing today in the Alberni region. we wanted to challenge the whole reason why poverty was happening. For example, the control of the land by McMillan Bloedel, the strong ties they had with the provincial government, that, as it turned out, with the United Church as well. And, you know, we began to question, I guess, the whole power structure in the area and how Native people and poor people were on the bottom of that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, for other reasons, too, I guess I wasn't becoming very popular in among certain people. But, you know, as the turnout on Sunday indicated, there was a real support, I think, among others for what I was attempting to bring out, which was simply the hidden history, I think.
Right. Well, I'd like to talk about the events that led up to your expulsion and some of these other activities that you were involved in that may have played a part in that. Now, you'd mentioned McMillan Bloedel, and I understand there were some land dealings with the United Church and McMillan Bloedel. I wonder if you could speak about that.
Well, again, I stumbled across this because I had developed a fairly good relationship with some of the local elders. Now, in that area, there's a nation called the Yahauzit people on the west coast. This is around Tofino on the west coast of Vancouver Island. And they traditionally were one of the targets of the missionaries. A lot of the Yahauzits come and live in Port Alberni, although the traditional land is on the west coast. And for folks back east who might not know, Port Alberni is pretty much in the center of Vancouver Island. It's up an inlet. But on the west coast near Long Beach, there's this area called the Yahauza Territory. And the two United Church residential schools were in Yahauzit and Port Alberni. And the Yahauzits had given the Presbyterians and then the United Church, into which the Presbyterians went in 1925, they'd given the church this land called Lot 363 on the Yahauza Reserve for the church to build their residential school on. And this was never sold to the church. I mean, in the Yahauza culture, of course, there was no notion of buying and selling land. It was simply, you know, given in trust to the church, but it was always a house of land. And in 1953, the church took this land and sold it to a local businessman called Hamilton Ross. Now, he was the grandson of the original church missionary to the coast, a guy called John Ross, who, very odd, I mean, it shows you how closely linked church and state are traditionally out here. John Ross was the Presbyterian missionary. He was also the local magistrate, so he was the judge and jury for any local native who did something like potlatch or conduct their local dances, both of which were you know, outlawed under in the criminal code in Canada. You couldn't potlatch or really do any traditional native culture activity, or you'd be put in prison. Well, imagine, you know, the local missionary is also the one who went around to native homes and would arrest elders. And in fact, he did that. He had quite a reputation. But anyway, his grandson, Hamilton Ross, gets sold the land by the United Church for about $2,000. Now, that's 100 hectares of old-growth red cedar. You know, and Hamilton Ross gets it very cheaply. It's like an inside deal to a church insider. Well, Ross has a very close connection to McMillan Bloedel, and within a couple of years, he sold off most of the land to McMillan Bloedel for only $6,000. You know, meanwhile, not a penny of this has gone back to the Yahauzits, and the United Church has violated their own policy, which is, and it says very clearly, that they're not to sell off any native land to white business interests, but it's to return to the original native nation. Well, eventually, McMillan Bloedel gets all the land, and what was very interesting is that one of the actually, the month I got to Port Alberni, one of the local Yahauzit elders, a guy called Chief Earl George, wrote to the provincial government and said, I want this land back. The church should never have sold it to McMillan Bloedel. And I claim it as keeper of the land. I claim this land. Well, the chief forester for BC stopped all cutting permits on the land, and he's ordered the United Church and McMillan Bloedel and the government to sit down with the Yahauzits and work this thing out. That created a major embarrassment for the church because their attitude was simply, well, we had the right to sell the land and it's not our issue anymore, but the government said it was, and so they had to sit down and work it out. As it turns out, the Aboriginal Affairs Minister at the time was a guy called John Kishore, and he's also a United Church clergyman. I mean, the ties here are direct when you talk about collusion. basically John Kishore found that his church was becoming very embarrassed by what they had done, and he got them off the hook. I mean, nobody's ever questioned this as a conflict of interest, but the provincial cabinet minister used his office to save his church from embarrassment. He set up negotiations between the Ahausitz and Macmillan Bodell that left the United Church right out of all talks. And Earl George, when he sat down and noticed the church wasn't there, said, well, wait a minute, they were the original landholders of this land. They sold it for a profit. And they even ran their residential school on it, where several kids were killed, according to eyewitnesses. So why are they pretending they're not part of this negotiation? Well, what happened to Earl was interesting, because at the same time he was training for United Church ministry. He was in his 60s, a very venerated spiritual elder in their community, and he was the first West Coast elder to be trained as a United Church minister. The seminary, the Vancouver School of Theology, had accepted him. His tribal council had paid his tuition, and the church, up until that point, had accepted his candidacy with great delight, really. Then he makes a stink about the United Church attempting to get out of the negotiations around Law 363, and suddenly he's notified by the conference, that's the provincial body of the United Church, that, hey, guess what, we don't have any money for you. This would have amounted to probably $4,000, and they subsequently spent, the same body spent about $250,000 expelling me from the United Church. So you can see that this whole argument about not having money was just a fairy tale. Earl wrote the letter, embarrassed the church, and they threw him out. And they actually did that to me at the same time. In talking to Earl, I had discovered about this whole story about Lot 363. And I had written a letter to the presbyter. Now, that's the body I mentioned before, you know, that was my immediate supervisor. And I said, look, this was really wrong, what happened in the 1950s. The church should never have sold the land. We should simply sit down with the Ahausitz and work this out. Well, after I wrote that letter, the month after that, the presbytery began to hold secret meetings with my board. And from people who have given affidavits on the board, we learned that they were basically told, look, Kevin's about to be removed as minister, and it's out of your hands. He's to be taken out. And sure enough, within 6 weeks of me writing that letter, I was fired without cause. And, you know, the church, a couple of years later, then came up with some kind of after-the-fact justifications, but they never at the time gave me any reasons. And I know it was basically the fact that the two critics of this land deal, both Earl George and myself, were forced out of the United Church right in the same month by the same group of people. And what was significant about all that, too, is that Macmillan Bodell, who ended up getting all the land, which is now worth in the tens of millions of dollars easily. You see, it's some of the last of the old growth on that part of the coast. Macmillan Bodell is a major financial contributor to the United Church. It funds the Vancouver School of Theology, which is where United Church clergy are trained. It's got a charitable fund called the Macmillan Family Fund. And we did a bit of research, and believe it or not, in the very year that Earl George and I got thrown out of the church for criticizing the Macmillan Bodell land deal thing about Lot 363, the Macmillan Fund gives its largest donation ever to a church. It gave $8,000 tax-free grant to First United Church in Port Alberni, which I think was a direct payoff, kind of a thank you for having arranged all that. So, you know, what was really astounding about that whole thing was that there was this direct triangle between Macmillan Bodell, the United Church, and the provincial government. And certain actors like John Kishore were instrumental in that whole thing. But it gives you a sense of that what happened to me and others is because we touched upon this whole history and this continued kind of colonial arrangement going on between church, state, and the business sector, basically to get native land and resources and make it all seem legitimate.
Now, how did the church board feel about this decision by the Presbyterian? What was their response?
The decision of the presbytery to have me removed?
Yes.
Initially, the church board opposed it. In fact, the chair of my board resigned over the whole issue. They were very upset that the presbytery was simply stepping in and taking me out like that, especially since I had tripled the size of the congregation. I mean, there were differences, of course. I mean, there always are in churches over what went on, but there was not enough disagreement to have me removed, and people were clear about that. The presbytery, basically, though, under the United Church Manual, has the right to disregard what a local congregation thinks. And, in fact, the rules were changed just last year in the United Church. Any presbytery now can step in and remove a minister without cause, without even having to justify the decision to the board of that minister's own church. So it's a very, despite the popular image of the United Church, it's a very kind of hierarchical system they have when it comes to disciplining ministers.
And a very warped sense of discipline as well. I had aired a lecture about how ministers that have been involved in child sexual abuse simply are moved to other churches and don't really face any kind of retribution by the church as an institution.
Well, in fact, as a matter of fact, when we had exactly that case happen in Port Alberni, where a woman came to me and said that she had been molested by a United Church minister in 1962 right at St. Andrew's Church in Port Alberni, and she had gone to, her parents had gone to the RCMP and the United Church about it, and she claims that they all sat down and they were pressured not to talk about the incident, and the minister was then sent out to the West Coast to work in the West Coast missions, which is among the native people. So in fact, they were not only protecting this minister, who's now retired living up in Nelson, but they were not only protecting him, but they were sending him out among native people where that pedophilia and abuse had been operating for many decades, and they knew he could continue safely there without anybody objecting or even knowing about it.
Incredible. And hundreds of cases similar to that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's rampant, and the government and churches now are admitting it.
Yeah.
But at the same time, they're getting rid of the whistleblowers, and they're very much covering their tracks about all this stuff.
Right. What other kind of threats have you received for the work that you've been doing, and where have those threats come from?
Well, at first the threats just came from within the church. I was fired without cause. I was prevented from working in the church altogether. There was an amazing smear campaign that went on about me. And there was, as I began to become more involved in working with residential school victims in Vancouver, and we held a series of forums and even a tribunal into the residential schools, the threats began to intensify. I would get letters from United Church lawyers threatening to sue me unless I ceased and desist making statements about the church. I just ignored it, and in fact the lawsuits have never come, which I think is significant, because if there was something that wasn't true, they would have long ago tried to sue me. But I think they recognize that I'm onto something, and so they're kind of desperate. There have been death threats. I've had the brake lines in my car cut twice. That was after the tribunal we held last summer in Vancouver, where even more serious things began to come out about pedophile rings that continue to operate in Vancouver, and usually with the support of native officials who were providing children, apparently, to various dignitaries in Vancouver. I can mention that a bit later. But
yeah, I'd like to go into that in more detail a bit later.
Yeah, but, you know, there have been overt and more covert kinds of threats going on, including against the people who have helped me. I mean, I remember there was a very good article that was printed in a community newspaper back in 1997 about the whole story and about all the kind of gory details of the church and the McMillan-Bodell's dealings and some of the murders that occurred in the schools. And the reporter who wrote that article was harassed by a couple of officials in the United Church at her home. They called her editor and tried to get her fired from the newspaper. And, I mean, you know, they really tend to turn the screws on to anybody who supports the investigation or supports my case.
Did you, what kind of response did you get from the church and the NDP government at the time regarding your rapid expulsion and the lack of due process? Did you try to make any appeals within the church?
Oh, yeah. I appealed. I went through all the steps because my lawyers were saying, you know, you have to what they call exhaust the internal remedies before you can go to a court and sue these people. So I appealed it at every level of the church, and it was like a huge rubber stamp. The church, on the one hand, stated in writing there were no charges against me. I had done nothing wrong, but I was being removed for what they called the peace and order of the church, which is kind of a blank check they provide themselves to remove anybody they don't like. But I appealed it to all three levels of the church, right up to the General Council in Toronto. And my appeals were all rejected, and then I was formally what they called delisted. That hearing went on for 6 months, and what was interesting about it was that the church officials themselves made some quite amazing statements. For example, one of them, a presbytery official called Wynne Stokes, who had me removed, stated that right before I was fired, John Kishore, the Aboriginal Affairs Minister, and another United Church clergyman had spoken to him and said, "We can't have Kevin upset the apple cart over Lot 363. So they seem to be admitting that a provincial government minister played some role in my removal as a minister in Port Alberni, because I had helped highlight this deal that had gone on, by which McMillan Bledel got this land.
Did you have peers within the church, other ministers that gave you support?
Well, the support at first there was quite a lot of it there, but as it was clear to ministers that the whole institution was pretty much lining up against me, they knew, I guess, what they had to do in their own mind, and they all backed off, except one. The minister to the Ahouse people, Bruce Gunn, was not only a supporter all the way along, but he was one of my advocates at my delisting hearing. Mm-hmm. That cost Bruce his job. He was forced from his work with the Ahouseets, and he's working up north now as a counselor in Telegraph Creek with some native bands there. But anybody who helped me paid a price for it. And it was interesting during my hearing. I would be getting anonymous phone calls from ministers, including one fellow I remember who's fairly senior in the whole church, and he said basically, "I'd like to help you, but I've been told by the personnel minister for the conference, a guy called Art Anderson, I was told by him that I would lose my job if I supported you, Kevin, so I can't." And it was that kind of overt kind of pressure that I was hearing from people all the time within the church.
Hmm. I'd like to talk a bit about the history of residential schools in general. And can you tell us when did these residential schools start, over what time period the churches ran these schools?
Well, the Indian Act actually set them up in the 1880s, but they didn't get into operation until probably close to the turn of the century. On the West Coast here, there were residential schools operated by the mainline churches by the 1890s. Now, this would be the Catholics, who had more than half of them, the Anglicans, and then the Methodists and Presbyterians. Now, the Methodists and Presbyterians both joined the United Church, so by 1925, you'd have the Anglican, Catholic, and United Churches basically running these schools. And they were run on a remarkably similar basis, and there was little, if any, government supervision of these schools. It's something I've discovered looking through the Indian Affairs Archives at UBC, at the University of British Columbia, where I'm doing a doctoral degree. I have access there to correspondence and records from Indian Affairs, and all their letters to the churches around the residential schools going back almost a century. And it's amazing the degree of cover-up and looking the other way that went on around these schools.
So the government seemed to be aware of what was going on. Do you believe that they had a part in the activities that the church was conducting at these schools?
Oh, very much. I mean, they. What was significant was, under the Indian Act, Indians were legal wards of the state from the 1880s on, which meant that, they were considered children under the law. The government ran everything on their behalf. Well, I found a document that showed that in the 1930s and 1940s, the government systematically transferred guardianship rights over the Indian children to the churches. So the principal of the residential school actually was the legal guardian of these students. That explains a lot in terms of how they could get away with all these abuses and even killings for so long, because as the Indian parents surrendered their rights over their own children when they signed what was called an application for admission form into the schools, they made the principal the legal guardian of their own children. And they had to, under the law, they'd be arrested or fined. So really, as an Indian parent, you had no control over what went on. And the church could literally get away with murder because they were the guardians of these children. But as to the, you know, the knowledge of the government about this, it's interesting. There was an article in the Vancouver Province in at the end of October last year, and it was entitled "Church School Victim Got No Help." It was describing a man who was suing the church who ended up killing himself because of being badgered on the witness stand by a United Church lawyer. And it turns out when this child, Daryl Watts, he was 40 years old, he went to the Alberni United Church School. When he was taken from his parents, they never consented. They never signed the release document, you know, to allow him, the principal, to be his legal guardian. So, in fact, the church literally kidnapped this child and was holding him illegally. And it, in the same article, it admits that in 1960, to quote the article, the church in Ottawa were informed of widespread sexual abuse at the schools, but Ottawa responded with a directive to keep the incidents out of the media.
Now he that seeketh and is living shall live.
We've been listening to an interview with Reverend Kevin Annette, former minister of United Church in Port Alberni, and we'll be continuing that interview for the next week for the full hour from 9:30 to 10:30. Where he'll be speaking more on the abuses in the residential schools at Port Alberni and across Canada.